This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A little bit later in the hour, a green powerboat sets a record for making it around the world faster than anybody else, and oil drilling. But first, Heliobacter pylori. H. pylori is an intestinal bacterium that has made a home for itself in the human gut for thousands of years, and it's a common cause for stomach ulcers. Researchers say it's been all but eradicated in the last few decades by better hygiene and antibiotics. But while ulcers are on the decline, another health problem is on the rise, and you know, that's asthma. Well, is there a connection between the two? Could be. There is a new study published this week in the Journal of Infectious Diseases that suggests that H. pylori, the bacteria in our gut, may not be all bad after all. They may, in fact, be protecting kids from childhood asthma. Here to talk about the stomach bug and asthma is Martin Blaser. Dr. Blaser is chair of medicine and professor of microbiology at New York University here in New York City. Welcome to Science Friday.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How can a bacterium in the gut protect the respiratory system?
Well, I think your viewers might, your listeners might be interested to know that most of the cells in the human body are bacteria. They're not human cells at all. They're bacterial cells, about 90%.
Is that right?
Yeah, and not just for humans, but for just about all animals. And these bacteria have been living in us as long as we've been humans and beforehand. They're not accidental at all. Mm-hmm. And they're probably playing many different roles in human physiology. And we've been interested in Helicobacter for more than 20 years. And in particular, as you mentioned, we're particularly struck by the fact that Helicobacter pylori, an organism that has been with us at least since humans left Africa, is disappearing. And it's been disappearing very rapidly. As you said, from our most recent work, the work that Dr. Yu Chen and I did, less than 6% of U.S. children have Helicobacter pylori today.
And so at the same time, you're seeing a rise in asthma.
As Helicobacter is declining, yeah, ulcers are going away, stomach cancer is going away, and diseases of the esophagus, like reflux esophagitis, is rising, and so is asthma.
Huh. Can you create a one-on-one comparison or link between the two?
Well, we have been interested in this trend for a number of years and showed about 10 years ago an inverse relationship between Helicobacter and GERD, or reflux, and some of its consequences. And because some patients with GERD also have asthma, and sometimes when you treat GERD, asthma gets better, we thought if Helicobacter could be protecting against GERD, maybe it's protecting against asthma. So Dr. Chen and I began a study actually a couple of years ago where we looked at national data, the NHANES data set, which is a random nationwide survey. We looked at NHANES 3, and which was done in 1988 to 1991. And Dr. Chen found more than 7,000 records of people who had information on Helicobacter status and asthma status. And we found that people who had Helicobacter were less likely to have asthma than people without. But it wasn't just asthma. It was also hay fever, and it was eczema and skin sensitization, all of these allergic manifestations that run together. And we were very excited about this result because we had an earlier result in New York that showed almost the same findings. So more recently, we did the study that was just published this week looking at NHANES 4, now almost 10 years later. And in particular, our first two studies suggested that if Helicobacter had some protective role, it was in childhood onset asthma, the asthma that occurs very early in life, and not in adult asthma. And NHANES 4 was weighted toward more children. And we also found more than 7,000 records of people who we could study. And we found, again, the same inverse association between Helicobacter and childhood asthma, very specifically.
So you're saying you didn't find that association in adults?
We did not find it in adults. And in particular, I want to emphasize we're talking about when asthma arises.
Yeah.
There's childhood asthma, which arises very early in life. It's associated with these other allergic conditions. Adult onset asthma can be related to allergy. It can be related to smoking and other factors. Whatever the case, we did not find any relationship with H. pylori.
So you're saying that in doing all this research, it may be the allergy reaction in general different kinds of illnesses that have a relationship with the bacterium.
That's right. In other words, it could be. I mean, there are really two major possibilities.
Yeah.
One is that our studying Helicobacter is just a marker for something else. Something makes Helicobacter go away, and that's also affecting the real protective factor against asthma. It could be antibiotics affecting another bacterium. The other possibility is that H. pylori itself is protecting against asthma, and we don't have any proof, but that's the hypothesis I favor.
Mm-hmm.
And we think that Helicobacter is helping arm the immune system in a way that regulates allergy.
Wow. Can you set up an experiment that would test that hypothesis?
Well, we're trying to test the hypothesis in a number of ways. We may be able to collaborate with colleagues and look at animal models of asthma. There's a model of asthma in rhesus monkeys. We're interested in studying the kinds of regulatory cells and the kinds of regulatory substances in the blood of people who have Helicobacter and who do not have it, so that we can further develop the mechanisms of the association.
Mm-hmm. So did this decline in H. pylori happen when antibiotics, post-World War II, antibiotics took over?
As far as we can tell, the decline in Helicobacter began early in the 20th century, but has continued and was probably accelerated after World War II with the invention and widespread use of antibiotics. And in that sense, the U.S. is leading the rest of the world, but the rest of the world seems to be catching up. Mm-hmm. Asthma is quite epidemic in the U.S. and other Western countries.
So if it's not linked to those antibiotics originally, then it's linked to other things like hygiene, things like that?
Hygiene, cleaner water, smaller family size. Most people haven't given much thought to it, but one of the things that we know is that families are a lot smaller than they used to be. And families are very important for transmission of microbes and other infectious agents. And this may be changing kind of human ecology.
You know, there was this research that's been talked about on and off for the last few years, talking about if kids are exposed to playing in the dirt, they get fewer cases of asthma.
So I can't tell you that much, but my general view is that the microbes in dirt are irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
They're not really adapted for humans. However, the microbes that have been living in humans and our ancestors for millions of years and now are disappearing, I think are much more relevant. I've called this the disappearing microbiota hypothesis. It's a little different than the hygiene hypothesis. And in this case, Helicobacter is kind of the indicator of that phenomenon. Helicobacter is the dominant organism in the stomach. And if an organism disappeared in the colon, the skin, the vagina, we probably wouldn't even be able to detect it.
Let me get a quick question from a listener in. Let's go to Srick in Louisville. Hi. Welcome to Science Friday. Are you there?
Oh, hi. Yes. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, I guess, slightly unrelated to the Helicobacter, but apparently one of the hypotheses behind the emergence of inflammatory bowel diseases like ulcerative colitis is that it might have something to do with the disturbance of the equilibrium of bacteria in the gut. And I was wondering if your guest had some comments about that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the things is that apparently it's also very highly prevalent in the West and not so much in Asian countries. And
let me get an answer.
Well, you know, you really said the key word, which is equilibrium. That's really how we are viewing this, that we live in some kind of equilibrium with our microbes. And our hypothesis, at least with relation to the stomach and asthma, is that that equilibrium has been disturbed. As I said before, that equilibrium could be disturbed in many places of the body, except that we don't have the candidates right now. We don't know exactly which microbe it could be.
That's fascinating. You say that there are more microbes, more germs living in our body than cells.
Yeah, 90% of your body is microbes.
And we don't understand then.
we understand very little. And that's one of the reasons that the National Institute of Health has made the human microbiome one of their big research projects over the next 4 years, to really understand what are the normal microbes of the human body and how they affect human health and disease.
So when we treat disease and we don't know anything about most of the germs that are living in us.
Well, exactly. You know, 20 years ago, if I told you that every time you turn the ignition on your car, the polar ice cap is going to melt a little, you would have laughed. And if I tell you today that every time you take an antibiotic, you're chipping away at your microbiome and the microbiome that you transmit to other people, and that all these 50 or 60 years of antibiotics are actually changing our microbial composition, that's about as far-fetched as that other thing was.
Yet we do, and we must learn to understand that, if then, as you say, if we're going to be treating illnesses.
Right. Our hypothesis is that every time somebody takes an antibiotic for a throat infection or an ear infection, it's having an effect on the microbiota. Again, using Helicobacter as the indicator, there's evidence that this is correct.
But you're saying also it started before we even took antibiotics.
It did, because it had to do with the transmission of the microbes from person to person, and that's where issues like crowding, cleanliness of the water, and issues like family size. You know, another thing that could affect it is that more babies are born today from cesarean sections rather than going through birth the traditional way. More babies are fed with formula than being breastfed. All of these things affect the microbes that are being transmitted, let's say, from mothers to their children.
Fascinating, Dr. Blaser. Fascinating. Thank you for taking time to be with us.
Yeah, my great pleasure.
And good luck to your research.
Thank you so much.
He's Dr. Martin Blaser, professor of microbiology and chair of medicine at New York University. We're going to take a break, switch gears, and come back and talk to the captain of a racing boat, a boat that set a world's record of time, speed for going around the world. And it's not made out of your uncle's, this is not your uncle's car. So stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Imagine 60 days spent zooming around the oceans, smashing through 40-foot waves, swimming with tiger sharks, and meeting hundreds of thousands of people. Earth Race is a powerboat that did just that. And at the end of June, Earth Race and its crew set an around-the-world speed record. But perhaps more importantly than all of this, Earth Race is an Earth-friendly boat. Its hull is partially made of the natural fiber hemp. The ship, the boat itself, is fueled by biodiesel made from all sorts of sustainable materials, from vegetable oil to human fat, if you call that sustainable. The crew eats locally and wears recycled clothing. Earth Race skipper Pete Bethune joins us from Norway, where he is aboard the boat to talk about the ship's environmental world tour. Welcome to Science Friday.
G'day, mate. It's good to be here.
Thank you. Tell us about this boat. What makes your boat different than any other racing boat?
It's the first tri-hull wave piercer ever built. So tri-hull means it's got three hulls, and the wave-piercing part, it's very slender, a lot of weight in the bow from fuel that we pump in there, and it punches straight through waves rather than riding over the top. And to put in perspective, we've had 40-foot waves and about 15 to 20-foot of wave over the top of the windshield as we've kind of cut through the middle of those waves. So it's a very cool boat, but there's also a lot of green elements about this vessel.
It's made partially made of hemp, is that right?
Yeah, it's the first boat in the world that's used hemp composite, but hemp is actually, it's a fantastic composite material. It's got properties that are a little bit like Kevlar and a little bit like fiberglass, so it's very good on things like floor soles where you have a lot of small impacts. Not suitable for the very outside skin, but internally in the boat it's been used in many places. So just a renewable resource, and we were keen to promote it.
Now, you spent a lot of your own money on this, did you not?
Yeah, I made quite a lot of money when I was in the oil industry many years ago, and it's that money that I've spent on this, about $750,000 US, and I've loaned another $750,000, which was needed to get the boat in the water. And since then, mostly the project has been funded just by sponsorship and donations, and people pay $5 to go aboard the boat when we visit cities and things like that.
What's a chap in the oil industry doing making a green boat?
Yeah, it's like I swung over the dark side, isn't it? I finished up in the oil industry a while ago, and on leaving the industry, I guess I was worried about the real finite resource that oil is, and I started becoming interested in renewables, and after a while it became a passion, and in the end I put together this project called Earth Race and was just determined to make a positive contribution. Initially, it was really to promote biodiesel, but what's happened through the project is I realised we can connect with so many people on different levels, and it's a shame to make it purely about biodiesel. So we've tried to make this vessel just a green example of what you can do, and the way my crew conduct themselves and the technologies we use in the boat is all about reducing our environmental footprint.
1-800-989-8255 if you want to talk to the Earth Race skipper Pete Bethune, who's joining us from Norway. You say it's more, the boat does run on all kinds of biodiesel, but your message is more than biodiesel, you're saying.
Yeah, look, to give you an example, we run it as a carbon neutral project, and I firmly believe that something along the lines of the carbon credit system, for example, is imperative in that it recognises CO2 as a pollutant. So we promoted that quite a bit. We promote the idea of organic foods and people eating local foods, and often the quality of those foods is better because it hasn't travelled, but it's got a lower carbon footprint on it. Just many things we do. We all use public transport in whatever city we're in, and if you compare that with most super yachts that visit cities, they all have plush limousines and that driving them around. And we lead pretty good lives on this, but we also have a pretty low carbon footprint and environmental footprint.
Well, what do you say to people who said, well, if you're really a green boat, you should have a sailboat, like Pete Seeger has?
The trouble is people don't use wind energy to get to work. They use their cars. And there's always people who will want to lead exciting lives. And the message to them is you can still do that, but you need to think a little bit more about the choices that you make. And from recycling to the food you eat and the clothes you buy and the cars you buy, these all have an impact. And we just try and connect with various people on different levels. But, you know, sailing is well and good, but wind energy, it's good for generating electricity, but that's about it.
Mm-hmm. It's like Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger saying he has his Humvee converted to hydrogen. So he has his...
Not such a fan of hydrogen. The trouble with hydrogen is you do need huge amounts of electricity to make it, and it uses platinum as the catalyst, or the very good hydrogen vehicles do. And platinum is one of the scarcest resources we have on this globe, and I don't think there's enough platinum to go fueling 500 million cars around the world. There may be enough to do 250,000 or something like that.
Is it true that you got liposuction and used your own fat to fuel this boat?
Yeah, I was trying to highlight the fact that you can use so many different resources to make biodiesel from. And it's one of the good things about this fuel. You know, I'm really keen on communities and countries doing their own thing rather than it becoming a global industry where palm oil is shipped all over the world. And so I tried getting some friends of mine who were quite fat to undergo liposuction. One of them ended up saying, why don't you do it yourself if you're so keen? So I had a surgeon donated his time, and he got 100 mil of fat out of my back. But then I had a couple of fat buggers who they ended up donating 10 pounds each. So I had 20 pounds of human fat plus my little 100 mil, and I brewed it up in my kitchen at home. And I made, it was about 7 litres or so, about 2 gallons of biodiesel. And when we launched Earth Race, that was amongst the very first fuel that went through the boat.
You know, I think you may have stumbled on something here. I mean, all the overweight people want to have to decrease their carbon footprint. Maybe they could. I won't go there. Donate. That's not the point of your race. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Roy in Binghamton, New York. Hi, Roy.
Hey, hello.
Hey there.
Hey, I wanted to compliment you on putting an Earthship together and challenge you to sail up the Hudson and down into to Cayuga Lake to Ithaca, the alternate energy capital of the Northeast, and helped with a very big fight we have here involved the natural gas rush for the Marcellus Shale, where they're going to be injecting lots of toxic fluids into the ground and pumping up lots of radioactive water in the process. And that would be a great thing for you to come and help us out. We're being besieged by the gas industry. It's about to turn even possibly the New York City Reservoir into a potentially hazardous toxic water going to the city.
Yeah, look, send me an email, and if you stay on the line, someone there may be able to give you my email. Or just go to earthrace.net, send me an email. It's not impossible. We are organising the tour after Europe, and it's likely we will be going to a few places in North America. So send me an email. We like visiting places where we can make a positive impact, and it's certainly possible we may be able to make it there.
Yeah, if you go to sciencefriday.com, we have a link to his site, so you can be able to find
awesome.
It in many different ways. What's the reaction when you pull into some of these ports around the world and they see this magnificent boat of yours coming in?
It doesn't matter what the country is. There's always like this, man, what a cool boat. But the reaction to the environmental side of it differs quite a bit. And for example, most of Europe and North America, it connects pretty strongly with people. But in parts of Asia, the Middle East and that, it's more the cool boat, but the environmental messages don't really resonate so strongly with people there. And you find within countries it varies a little bit from city to city, and also from age groups. I've kind of found that someone who's of the age, say 15 to 30, environmental messages really connect with those people. But as people get older, it seems to have less of a connection with them. Just my humble thoughts on it over the last couple of years from having met so many people aboard this boat.
So you must have had some, meeting all these people, some scary moments in some of these ports.
We've had a few adventures on this. We were east of Nicaragua at one stage, and we had this. It just looked like pirates. There was five guys carrying assault rifles that pulled up beside us, and they called us up on radio and said, "We're the Colombian Navy. Stop your vessel." And there was no markings, no uniforms, so like they've got to be pirates. So we started to pull away, and they opened fire on us. And the first shot was fired, and I looked out in the window, and here's a guy lying on the bow with an M16 assault rifle, and I saw the muzzle flash, and then a second later, this dull thud as the bullet hit us. And so we started to pull away, and he said, "You've got 30 seconds to stop your boat or we will open fire." And they had five automatic weapons on this boat. And so I'm just tossing up whether I stop or keep going. And then he said to me, he said, "Captain, I want to know, how many crew have you got?" And I remember thinking, it's a very typical military terminology. So I started to think maybe he was Navy. And so over the next few minutes of discussions with him, I figured he probably was Navy. And then we stopped for him, and he came on the back and he put a pistol right to my forehead. And he said, "How come you never stopped?" And I'm looking on his head, and he's got the H.A. Quintos, which was the name of the big vessel he was from. And I said to the guy, I said, "Man, look at your boat. It doesn't look like a Navy vessel. And there's a skanky little 15-foot skiff blowing smoke." And he was quite indignant about it. And he said to me, "In Colombia, this is a very fine Navy vessel." That stands out as the scariest moment we've had. We've had a few big storms. We had one with 40-foot waves and 80-knot winds that just scared the hell out of us. I think we've done a total of 12 storms now. And storms always scare me.
So you must be a very big boat enthusiast your whole life then.
Not really, actually. I've had a boat for a few years back in New Zealand, but it was really just a way to go diving and fishing. And I consider myself a conservationist, and I spent a long time trying to work out what project I could run to promote biodiesel and promote, I guess, better living for people. And it was just a boat project that seemed to fit the bill. And I know a lot about boats and navigation and that now, but when I started this, I didn't really. But most of it's not that hard. Boats aren't rocket science, you know. They tend to make sense, and I've been very good at bringing in talented people around me to make this project happen, and the designers and the graphic artist and all the wonderful people who chipped in their time for free on this.
Why a boat? Why not a fancy train or a big plane, you know, a Branson plane or something like that?
The thing with boats is that you've got free rein to do what you like. You can make a boat as cool looking or as ugly, as long, as fat. You can do whatever you like. And if you look at Earthrace, like, it is the coolest looking boat in the world. And it's got some amazing technologies. And at the time, I just thought, look, I can make something really amazing looking that's going to capture people's imagination. Yeah. And it's exactly what we've done on Earthrace. The other things I looked at, like we're doing cars and trucks and vehicles, you're a lot more limited because it's got to go on a road and meet very stringent regulations and things like that. So I just thought this was the best thing to use.
So your message is you can be green and sexy at the same time.
Exactly.
Your boat doesn't have to be made out of papyrus to be a green boat.
That's right. There's so many different things you can do on your boat and in your everyday life. Like for me, the boat is just the way I transmit this message, and we try and just connect with people. But it's about how they lead their lives. It's not just about the boat. It's about the car they drive and the recycling they do and the materials they use in their house and the insulation. All of these things have an impact on their carbon footprint, and we're just trying to promote that.
Right, and you get their attention. The boat gives you their attention, and then you attention, and then you know that's the 2x4, and then you give your message.
That's right, and it's look, it's worked for us effectively in just about everywhere we've gone. But it connects with people for different reasons. It's been an unusual journey, this, and how different people relate to us for different reasons. And I've sort of found younger people, it tends to be more the environment. Older people tends to be more the adventure side of it.
Yeah.
Someone kind of taking on a great record and that sort of thing. But as long as they follow us and pick up a few of the messages, then we're succeeding.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Skipper Pete Beth here in this hour, Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Let's see if I can get a phone call or two in here. Let's go to Bill in San Francisco. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
I had a question. What was his route around the world? Did he go south of the Capes or through the canals? And as a quick follow-up, was his fuel tankage sufficient to fuel conveniently with his alternative fuel? And I'll take my question off the air.
Okay,
thank you
thanks.
Very much.
Yeah, to answer that, the route we had was you've got to go through the Suez and Panama canals, and those are two of the rules from the sanctioning body. So our route, we started in Spain. Now, this will test your geography. From Spain, the Azores, Puerto Rico, Panama, Manzanillo in Mexico, San Diego, Hawaii, Marshall Islands, Palau, Singapore, Cochin in India, Salalah in Oman, Suez Canal, and back to Saguntum in Spain. So that was the route that we followed. And sorry, what was the second question?
The question was, where did you fuel up? And did you have special spots you needed to tank up?
Oh, yeah, we had. We made sure they were all ports that we could get fuel to, and we had a single company, SGC Energia, who sponsored all of our fuel, and they arranged to ensure that we had it at all those locations. So we just turned up, and they had the fuel ready to go for us.
We have a video of your traverse of the Panama Canal on our website on Science Friday for anybody who wants to see.
Yeah, it was one of the coolest days I've had going through that canal. It is unbelievable what they achieved there. It's one of the great achievements of man, and you look how much energy that saves in terms of saving boats going down around the Horn there. It's an amazing place. They had 10,000 people died building that canal.
The places that you did tank up, are they normal biodiesel fuel places, or did you have to truck them in specially?
No, some of them we had to ship it in the same as they would ship in diesel. So, for example, the Marshall Islands and Palau, we end up having to ship it there because they don't have any local supplies. Although, interestingly now, Marshall Islands has got a biodiesel plant under construction, and we met with some government officials when we were there in 2007, and it looks like we had an impact there where they're now using their own coconut oil to make biodiesel from. Yeah. Wow.
Let's talk to phone to Kate in Sun Valley, Idaho. Hi, Kate.
Hello.
Hi there.
Yes, hello. I'm just more interested in, since we've been talking during the Science Friday about renewable resources, talking a little bit more about the hemp products you used, where you got them from. You know, being from Idaho, and one of our main industries is agriculture, and looking into how to move Idaho into the future, there's an interesting initiative.
All right, Kate, we're running out of time, so let me get an answer.
The hemp itself, it's a pretty flexible plant, and the hemp we used was grown in the Waikato region in New Zealand, and it comes like a woven sort of mat, like a material, and to make the boat out of it, it's just the same as you would make it out of fiberglass or carbon. You put a resin on it and leave it to set. But I think some of the states in the U.S., you've got some laws that may prevent planting hemp. It is related to the marijuana plant, but it's not like you get a high from it. I think you need a cigar the size of a softball bat to get a high from hemp. But I think there's issues in the U.S. over being able to plant it.
Yes, there are. There used to be the major cash crop before World War II. Hemp was used all over the place, and ropes and things like that. Well, I want to thank you, Skipper, for taking time to be with us, and hope that you have the, as they say, the wind at your back.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, mate.
And where's your next stop?
From here, we're to Halden in Norway, and then back to UK for about 5 weeks. And hopefully I get this boat back to New Zealand early next year and get home again.
Well, have a happy sail and a great race.
Great stuff. Thanks very much, eh?
Earth Race's skipper, Pete Bethune, who joined us from Norway, where he was aboard his boat, talking about his race around the world, where he beat the world record by 2 weeks. He said you could, you know, just go all the time. It's 14 days. It's not hard to do. Well, if you look at his boat on our website at sciencefriday.com, you'll see why. It's a huge, it's a pretty good, nice-looking boat. Stay with us. We're going to take a break and change gears, talk about offshore oil drilling and drilling in Alaska. So don't go away. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, and for the next few minutes, we're going to talk about drilling for oil. In response to spiraling gasoline prices, President Bush this week lifted a decades-old executive ban on offshore oil drilling, and there is talk about opening up more acreage in Alaska to oil wells, too. But how much oil is really below the ocean floors anyway? Down there for us to use and get it out in time to solve this gasoline crisis? And what's going on in Alaska? Is there enough there? Would we ever see it? I mean, we have a pipeline that runs out of Alaska. Do we have to build another pipeline to get it out of there, too? Here to answer hopefully many or all of these questions is Robert Kaufman. He is director of the Center for Energy and Environmental Studies at Boston University. He joined us by phone from there today. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Ira.
We've heard a lot of figures thrown out around the last week or two about how much oil there is, let's say, in the Gulf or offshore. How much oil is down there? Do we know?
Well, you can never know for sure until you actually drill wells. But what we think we know, or at least what the government thinks it knows, is that in areas that are available to drilling now, the government thinks we could recover about 41 billion barrels, and in areas that are currently off limits, there may be another about 19 billion barrels.
And how much of that would be salve to our oil addiction? How long would that last?
Well, you can't really think of it that way because you're never going to produce all this oil at once. So what happens is it gets spread out over time. And the government actually ran a little scenario. It said, well, what happens if we open up all the restricted areas to oil production and assume the market goes forward? And what they found was that it's really not going to make much of a difference. Really, we wouldn't see any kind of difference until about 2017 if we let the moratorium expire in 2012. We wouldn't see any difference until 2017. And then we're really talking very small percentage differences on the order of U.S. production being about 1 to 4% higher.
By then, gasoline could be $12 a gallon.
I certainly hope not.
Yeah. I mean, so it's not going to solve the immediate crisis.
I don't even think it's going to solve the long-term problem.
Yeah.
I really think it's kind of this distraction, kind of telling people or giving them this illusion that if we do this, we can really solve the problem, whereas at best, it's kind of like postponing the problem for a couple of minutes.
Well, let's play along for a minute, and let's talk about Alaska.
Okay.
How much oil is in Alaska?
Well, again, nobody knows. Well, actually, some people know. There has been one test drill well drilled into the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and as you might guess, the companies are not letting that out. But the U.S. Geological Survey has an idea about how much oil's out there, and they've run some scenarios as well. And if we start drilling today, we won't see more than, let's say, a million barrels per day for another decade. So just to put that number in context, a million barrels per day sounds like a lot, except when you realize the U.S. now uses between 20 and 21 million barrels per day, and the world as a whole uses about 85 or 86 million barrels per day. So again, we're talking about really, really small incremental changes. And the other thing to remember is that 1 point, let's say that extra million barrels per day, that would be on top of ongoing declines in the U.S. It's not like we can assume that U.S. production will stay at current levels. U.S. production has been declining since the early 1970s, despite higher prices, despite technological change, despite all the subsidies that government can throw at it.
Mm-hmm. And how would we get that oil out of Alaska?
Well, that's a great question, because one of the things that frustrates me about the discussion about Alaskan oil is it's really the discussion's missing the big point. That is, there's no way that oil's really going to make a significant effect on prices or even U.S. dependence on oil. But really what's going on is there is one of the largest fields ever discovered in the United States, the Alaskan North Shore field known as Prudhoe Bay. And because that field is so far north, the producers had to build this very long pipeline across Alaska down to Valdez, which is now infamous for that big oil tanker spill about 15 years ago or a long time ago. And that the people who built that pipeline had a specific lifetime in mind based upon the size of that field, and they've amortized the cost of that pipeline. If we start producing oil from the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, what the companies will do is build a short spur pipeline to the Trans-Alaskan pipeline system and then ship the oil down. And what that will allow them to do is to make huge amounts of money from operating that pipeline longer than they thought, because that pipeline's basically paid for. And again, there's nothing wrong with making money, but that's what the argument should be about. It shouldn't be about lowering oil prices or reducing U.S. dependence on imported oil.
Because the amount of oil is very small percentage.
Yeah, people really need to think, whenever they hear a potential solution, you need to think of the world oil market as one big pool of oil. And whatever happens on one side of the pool literally goes across the entire pool. So when people talk about reducing prices, you've got to be able to make the argument that this is going to have a big effect on the global supply-demand balance. And for better or for worse, there's really nothing we can do in the United States on the supply side to move that balance in a significant way.
Do the oil companies have sites on land that they haven't even drilled in yet?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. There are lots of sites. As I mentioned earlier, there are lots of sites on the outer continental shelf that are open for drilling. And as the government itself reported, in the sites that are currently open to drilling, there's about 40 billion barrels of oil, we think, there. It's another 18 that we think is off limits.
Mm-hmm. And how would they refine oil if they got more oil? Haven't they closed down hundreds of refineries?
Well, they have, but crude oil can get shipped all around the world. And so crude oil that's produced here can just be simply put on a tanker and shipped somewhere else and refined and either consumed there or shipped back to us. So the U.S. imports not a lot, but some of its motor gasoline.
1-800-989-8255. Mark in New Britain, Connecticut. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Just following up on what you were just discussing about the federal lands that the oil companies already have under lease and are not working those lands. Are there added costs involved? Is the oil on these already leased lands more difficult to get? Why are they so hot and bothered over the OCS in Alaska when they've already got these reserves under lease?
Well, the Outer Continental Shelf is not really a great place to drill. So I don't know if you remember, a few years back there was this flurry of excitement about well-known as Jack II. It was supposedly going to be the next savior of the U.S. oil balance because it did contain a lot of oil. But let's think about where that oil is. Mm-hmm. First of all, it's the sea at that point is 7,000 feet deep.
Give us a little geography lesson here.
Okay, so this is in the Gulf of Mexico, the Outer Continental shelf of Gulf of Mexico, so we're about 175 miles off the coast of Louisiana, at least the Jack II well is, and we're sitting in 7,000 feet of water, and then the oil is another 20,000 feet below the seabed. So that's 28,000 feet, and as I tell my students, I can't do math at the board, but that's many miles below the surface of the ocean. And so that creates all kinds of complexities. There's a shortage of ships that are able to kind of drill these very deep offshore wells. Furthermore, it's very hard to bring that oil to the surface. So a lot of fields, everybody's seen those great movies where you punch a hole in the ground and oil comes exploding to the surface. And that's great because we don't have to invest any energy to get the oil from below ground to the surface. But think about it, this oil, 28,000 feet below the surface, only about 5 to 10% of it would come to the surface in and of itself. We would have to invest a lot of energy to kind of bring that oil to the surface. And you could think about that, you know, think about what it takes to lift a gallon of water up several, many tens of Empire State Buildings. And that's what it would take to bring this oil to the surface. So just to put it in dollar terms, it costs about $100 to $150 million to drill a single well in this type of environment.
So that's a major investment.
Oh, yeah.
And that's why they're not drilling there.
Yeah, you know, well, they are drilling Jack too, but if you go back to the previous kind of price spike, one of the most expensive dry holes ever drilled was this Muckluck field off the coast of Alaska, which at the time cost about $100 million, and I'm not sure what that would rise to in current dollars, but it would certainly be much higher.
But if you're making $50 billion in profit, that doesn't sound like a lot of money to drill.
It doesn't, but, you know, oil companies are just like any other company, and you got to remember this, and I remember this writing this for my dissertation. Oil companies produce profits, not oil, and they will only produce oil so long as the profits from producing oil is greater than their other possible investments.
They could be sinking the money in other places.
That's right. Maybe even alternative fuels.
And that's what some of them are doing. We're talking about the drilling for oil this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Talking about drilling for oil with Robert Kaufman, director of the Center for Energy and Environmental Studies at Boston University. And I guess if you're getting $140 a barrel of oil, why spend the money on getting new oil if you're getting a lot for the old oil?
Well, you always have to be looking out for your future because oil companies know better than anybody else that oil in a field is going to run out. So they're always kind of looking for that next barrel. Most companies trying to maintain current levels of production.
But if you want to spend a few hundred million dollars instead of one spot, you know, you could invest in wind and solar and get a much bigger return on your buck.
Yeah, and eventually, in theory, an economist would tell you that's what the market may have hopefully signaled to these oil companies and entrepreneurs in general that, hey, there's oil out there, but really you can get a better return elsewhere. And indeed, the major oil companies like ExxonMobil, shareholders want about an 18% rate of return.
Right.
And there are relatively few opportunities outside of OPEC countries where you can earn that kind of rate of return on oil production opportunities.
You know, T. Boone Pickens is certainly no dummy.
Yeah,
he made his fortune in that business, and he's going to light up the Texas Panhandle with wind power.
Yeah, you know, I think you really have to never mind the academic on the phone, but you have to sit up and listen when a guy who made $1 billion drilling oil says we can't drill our way out of this one.
Yeah, so that you think really anybody who objectively looks at this idea has to come away thinking it's more politics talking than real business sense.
Yeah,
real economics.
I just don't see an argument for kind of the need to open up these areas of the Gulf or anywhere offshore.
Well, shouldn't people be able to see that for themselves?
Well, you know, one of the things to think about is it just doesn't sound like a bad idea. If somebody says, is more oil better than less oil, you're always going to say, well, more oil's better, or at least if you're not thinking of environmental consequences, you're always thinking more oil's better. The question is, what are your alternatives? And so it doesn't sound wrong, and that's the genius of political spin. What people say doesn't sound wrong.
And if it doesn't sound right this time, maybe in a couple of weeks you'll spin it a different way.
Yeah.
And make people think that this was your idea all the time.
That's right.
To begin with. So where do you think this is all going to end up? Do you think this will die away as a political issue sooner or later, or are you going to hang on for the rest of the game?
I think it's going to die away. I just think between the economy and other opportunities and issues that are going to arise, this idea of pushing for oil on the outer continental shelf is just not going to have this big political draw that a lot of politicians think it's going to have.
Mm-hmm. And certainly in this age where a lot of people are getting their news from the internet and other sources.
Yeah, if I could put in a shameless plug, one of the things that I do is I give talks to journalists on how to report oil stories, and we talk about a lot of urban myths in the oil market. And they've actually recorded one of my talks along with a PowerPoint slide. So if you want to check it out, it's at www.facsnet.org, and it's facsnet.org. And they're the Foundation for American Communications, a small nonprofit organization.
Because we journalists need more education in this than...
It's very hard when journalists come to my office. Oftentimes I have to tell them, without sounding too arrogant, which, as you can tell over the phone, is kind of hard, that they're asking the wrong question because they've been guided by the political dialogue rather than what's really happening in the market.
They have to learn to think for themselves.
Yeah, well, it's hard. You know, I empathize with reporters. I can't imagine asking intelligent questions of my colleagues here at BU in areas that I'm not terribly familiar with.
And that's a good way to end our discussion, Doctor. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Robert Kaufman is the director of the Center for Energy and Environmental Studies at Boston University. That's all the time we have for today. Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help today from NPR librarian Kim Maleski. We gave out a lot of URLs, a lot of website tags. If you missed any of them and you want to see the film of the racing boat going through the Panama Canal, go to our website at sciencefriday.com. We've got all those links there for you. Also, we're blogging and podcasting and looking for some of the videos you may have for us. So you can also send us email there and give us any of your ideas that you'd like to see in the future. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.